Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The state recently conducted its latest survey of Delawareans about climate change and what could be done to address it.
We're at the point in the development of our statewide climate action plan that we wanted to test the water a bit about how people feel about the specific actions that can be taken.
We delve into the state's climate change survey results and how they help the state develop its strategy to address climate issues. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. In our playlist, we preview Opera Delaware's new season, which includes a mix of classics, new works, and even an opera where no one dies. And we bring you the final episode of the Delaware Humanities People and Planet podcast. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware's Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control recently released its latest survey of Delawareans' opinions on climate change. This is the fourth time since 2009 DENREC has taken the public's temperature on climate change and related issues. The results continue to show an overwhelming majority of state residents are concerned about climate change and view it as a serious threat. And these results will be used to help craft Delaware's 2025 Climate Action Plan, due to be delivered later this year. I recently sat down with DENREC's Climate and Sustainability Program Administrator Susan Love to discuss these survey results and how they'll help state officials develop a plan to address climate issues in the years ahead. Susan, this is the fourth time the survey has been conducted since 2009, and I did notice a bit of a difference between this survey and previous ones. Previous ones talked about climate change and sea level rise. This one focuses solely on climate change without breaking out sea level rise. Was there a reason for that change?
Yeah, so when we started doing statewide scientific public opinion surveys in 2009, the focus of our climate change programming and public work was really focused on sea level rise. That's where the department started. That's where the state really started with our climate change work. We did a lot of work about sea level rise in 2009 through 2013, and we continue that work, but we've expanded our focus to all of the impacts of climate change. And I think there's also been an increasing awareness amongst people that climate change, yes, it means sea level rise, and sea level rise is one of the most immediate and noticeable impacts of climate change here in the state of Delaware, but it also means increasing precipitation and increasing temperatures as well.
With that in mind, as you were putting this edition of the survey together, were there some other changes you made to what you wanted to hear from people about? It looks like there was maybe a little bit more of an effort to dig into specific mitigation strategies. Was that a point of emphasis beyond just tracking the opinions for those baseline questions you ask each time?
Yeah, so in addition to understanding, you know, how people feel, are they concerned about climate change? Do they want more action on climate change? We're at the point in the development of our statewide climate action plan that we wanted maybe a little to test the water a bit about how people feel about the specific actions that can be taken. And in public dialogue about climate change and climate action, there's actually a very good agreement amongst Americans and Delawareans that climate change is happening and it's a problem. A lot of the debate then comes with, well, okay, it's a problem. What should we do about it? And I think that's really where you see a lot of the public debate is on the actions that we should take to both increase our resiliency to climate change and also reduce the emissions that cause climate change. And so we wanted some better information about where Delawareans stood on some of the types of common sense actions that the state would like to take to address climate change.
Before we talk about some of that, let's talk a little bit about the top line results in the survey. 74% of respondents said they are concerned about climate change. 79% view it as a serious threat. That's up from 64% and 77% in 2019, 53 and 77 back in the first one, 2009. Is that encouraging that the concern and level of concern remain high, that Delaware, you know, as you mentioned, even the country at, you know, large, don't seem to have a huge climate change denial issue at this juncture?
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, because if you grabbed somebody off the street and you said to them, hey, do you think there's a disagreement about whether climate change is happening? I think they might say, yeah, the country is divided and the state is divided about whether climate change is a threat and whether we should be doing anything about it. But that's untrue. When you do this kind of scientific polling that we've done here and that's been done throughout the country with other partners, you do understand that the general American is concerned about these issues. They just might not show up at public workshops and things like that. But yeah, so it's encouraging, and that helps us as policymakers and as people who are on the ground trying to help the state prepare to know that people are concerned about this, and this is something that we want to take common sense action to address.
One number that did jump out to me was the percentage of people who agree that they can personally take action to reduce climate change. That's 59%, and that's down from the mid-60s in the last two surveys. Is that concerning, that an indication maybe people feel a little bit more helpless about what they can do about climate change?
There hasn't been a change in people disagreeing that they can take action. It's just that they sort of went from my personal actions can make a difference, and they've sort of moved into the neutral territory. I really think that this is a reflection of the growing understanding of just how big this problem is, and that the solutions for climate change are global, and that national policy, international policy, state policy, and business actions affect the choices that we as individuals have. And I think that the polling that we've seen really reflects that. Yes, I can take action as an individual, but I am dependent upon businesses taking action so that I can take action, or I'm dependent upon government policy, either at the local, state, national, or international level, so that I can take those actions.
Looking a little bit deeper into the survey, there is very strong support, over 70%, for mitigations like prohibiting new construction in areas designated as flood zones and using public funds for beach restoration projects on ocean and bay beaches. Less support for things like EVs, 53%, offshore wind, 59%. Those last two items have certainly seen some controversy locally over the last few years and even currently. Does the state have some work to do to explain the benefits of those type of mitigation efforts, or is there a sense that there's maybe just a ceiling for support for things like EVs and wind as opposed to some of these other mitigation efforts?
So I want to touch back to what you said. There's lower levels of support for newer technologies like electric vehicles and offshore wind, but still over 50%. And even though offshore wind, 59% of people we polled either moderately or strongly supported development of offshore wind for clean energy, that doesn't mean that, I can't do the math in my head that quickly, but that doesn't, we also had a large percentage of people who were neutral about that or didn't know. And so the number of people who said they opposed that action was actually in the 20%. So that provides us with a lot of background and information for which to move forward. But certainly education, outreach, and particularly around the types of technologies that we're asking people to consider for incorporation into their lives, like electric vehicles, is important. And so, yeah, we have lots of work to do to educate, to build out infrastructure, to help people understand the benefits of these new technologies. But I was encouraged by what we saw in this survey.
The survey is one tool to help inform, as you noted earlier, the latest update to the state's climate action plan. For those who may not know a whole lot about the plan, what is it designed to do?
So the climate action plan is really our state's playbook for how we will address both the impacts of climate change that are happening on the ground today in our state, and also to reduce the emissions that cause climate change. The state now has statewide targets for meeting emission reductions, and we also always want to improve our ability to bounce back and respond to sea level rise and flooding and high temperature events. And so this plan is our playbook for that. And it will outline a series of strategies and actions that the state, working with partners and local governments and businesses, can take to better be prepared for climate change today and in the future.
So how does the survey fit into updating the plan? How much weight does it have? What role does it play?
In developing the plan, we always want to get as much public feedback as possible. And over the past really 2 years, our team has been convening workshops and meetings and going to public events with a table and showing up at community meetings to talk about climate change. But even so, we know that not everybody is out at these events, and not everybody shows up at public workshops hosted by DENREC. Most people want to go home and have dinner and relax. Not everybody wants to come to a government meeting on a Tuesday night, right? And sometimes the people who come to those meetings have reason to be there. And so they're people who are very engaged and have very strong feelings, you know, one way or the other. We don't get a lot of the just normal people who think it's important, but don't have the time or ability to show up for one reason or another. So this survey helps us understand where most Delawareans are, because we know people just can't always come and engage even if they'd like to. So this is one of half a dozen different pieces that we utilize to better understand what Delawareans think, what's important to them, and then we use that to try to prioritize the types of actions that go into this plan.
You mentioned the public workshops. There are some opportunities for the public to get involved in the next month at public workshops in each county. What do those workshops entail? What do they look like for someone who might be interested in going?
Well, the workshops are in person, and they are designed as a drop-in style. People can come anytime between the hours of 4 and 7 and engage at a series of stations that focus on topics of interest. So if you're particularly interested in, let's say, transportation, you can come and talk to our experts in transportation. If you're particularly interested in flooding, you can come talk to our experts in flooding, or you can look at all of the topics that we have. We will also be sharing a series of strategies and actions that we have drafted up for inclusion in the Climate Action Plan, and you have an opportunity to provide your feedback and comments.
As we start to wind down, are there any results in the survey that jumped out to you as important compared to previous surveys that you took special note of as you're preparing for these workshops and putting together the Climate Action Plan?
One of the things that really stood out to me as I was looking through the results was that people who identify as of Hispanic or Latino background were more likely than others to agree that we need to improve public information about the effects of climate change. And so to me, that was really impactful because that showed that we have an opportunity to do a better job in Spanish-speaking communities to get this information out. And so I'm taking that to heart and know that we have a door opening to do a better job in getting information out to some of our Spanish-speaking communities.
Just want to wrap up by asking, when will the new Climate Action Plan be ready? When can we expect to see the results of all this?
The Climate Action Plan will be delivered this November in 2025. And the workshops, also importantly, the workshops are September 16th, 18th, and 23rd in Wilmington, Georgetown, and Dover, respectively.
Thanks to DENREC's Climate and Sustainability Program Administrator, Susan Law, for joining us on The Green this week. The first of this month's public information and input sessions is September 16th at Deltek's George Campus in Newcastle County from 4 to 7 p.m. You can find the dates for the Kent and Sussex sessions at our website, DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us for Arts Playlist, where we preview the upcoming season for Opera Delaware. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Opera Delaware is gearing up for a new season. Anchored by two masterworks, Tosca and Andrea Chenier, the upcoming season also features some innovative performances intended to dismantle the stereotype of opera's stuffy and staid, including opera deathmatch and a chamber work where a cell phone plays a major role. On this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny chats with Opera Delaware's Vice President of Engagement, Carrie-Anne Otagno, and soprano Emily Markovich, one of the opera's company artists.
The upcoming season is such a interesting, diverse season, so we've got a lot to unpack here, but I want to start with sort of the two big late Romantic masterworks, Puccini's Tosca and Giordano's Andrea Chenier. Talk to me about those works and how they fit into this theme of passion in the face of power.
Mm. as we were discussing this upcoming season and discussing it for the first time with the company artists as a part of the artistic planning, we realized that what we're doing is really revolutionary. To involve artists, to kind of strike down this idea of starving, suffering artists, to really revolutionize this whole approach. And so these pieces that we chose, Tosca and Andrea Chenier, are really focused on the role that artists play in revolution. They're the role of artists in resistance. And apart from that, they are some of the most like lush scores and most fulfilling music to get to sing. And so we were really conscious of the talent that we had in our company artist model with Emily Markovich, Dane Suarez, Tony Marie Palmertree, and Gerard Moon of what was going to make them shine. So we wanted dramatically the story of Opera Delaware being part of this revolution and also the artists that we have to really put them in the greatest spotlight. And Emily is making her role debut as Tosca, having last year performed Musetta for us. She is one of the most dynamic artists I've ever seen on stage. She is such a storyteller. And for her to be able to tackle something like this is really, really major. Then in the spring, when we're doing Andrea Chenier, that's going to be when Opera Delaware, for the first time ever, is hosting the Opera America Conference. So we're going to have representatives from opera companies across the country. About 500 opera professionals are going to come to Wilmington, Delaware for the first time. Massive, massive opportunity. And we get to spotlight Tony Marie Palmertree and Dane Suarez and Gerard Moon, three of our other company artists, who are going to be tackling the most major roles possibly of their career in this Andrea Chenier. And it's really us standing 10 toes down and saying we invest in these artists and they invest in us.
And you mentioned the role of the artist as revolutionary, as resistor. How does that inform the way these two operas are presented, the staging, the costumes? How does it inform the production?
So at Opera Delaware, we tend to do really traditional productions. So for Andrea Chenier, that's set during the French Revolution, but we want them to be evocative both of a past time and also what we're currently experiencing as a society now. And so while the production itself is going to be of the time period that it's set in, to see people like Emily, to see people that you see on the streets, to get their perspective, reminds us, I think, that these revolutionary characters were just regular people like us who made a stand. They were just artists who had something to say. They were poets who were brave enough to not concede. And that's what we see in Tosca and Andrea Chenier. We see these artists who have backbones of steel, who are fearless in the face of fascism, in the face of authoritarianism. And I think that is going to really resonate with our audience in this time that we're in. And it's also, again, I just cannot stress enough like how much this music will stir and move you and empower you and make you feel like I want to be a part of something.
You know, doing these two masterwork operas would be enough, but there's a lot more going on too. And beyond those big masterworks, one work that you're doing this season that I am unfamiliar with and absolutely fascinated by is kind of a new chamber opera. And one of the main things in this opera is the role of the cell phone. Tell me about service provider.
It is so clever and funny and inventive and quick. And when we were talking about putting together this season, we wanted it to be things that were great in the Opera Delaware studios, but could live beyond the Opera Delaware studios. So in January, we're going to be presenting Service Provider alongside a reduction of Pagliacci. Both of these operas are focused on a love triangle. Both of these operas are full of, you know, all of the drama and the intrigue that you would expect, but one has a very comic twist and one has a very tragic twist. But for both of these, we see them having legs outside of what we just do in the Opera Delaware studios. We could perform Service Provider. You're absolutely right that one of the characters is just the sound of ringtones, because that's how they end up getting caught. It's a married couple out at a restaurant for their anniversary, and the husband's mistress shows up, and text messages are going, and you're hearing the different the different ringtones and stuff. So that is a character in the show. So to see the way that we could transport that and present it in restaurants across the state, that this could be part of, you know, a really fun night out where you're going to have a beautiful dinner. And then in the middle of the dinner, you're going to have this impromptu 25-minute comic opera in English. I want that to be one of the entry points that people make with opera. Maybe this is an easier first step, and you can see how fun it is. You can see how silly it is. You can see how campy it is. And you can fall in love with it. And I see this as a great, great entry point. So that'll be in January that we present this. But then we're hoping that in the spring and summer, we're going to be taking it across the state.
I also have to ask you about Opera Deathmatch. Please tell me about Opera Deathmatch.
One of my favorite people in Delaware is Dave Tiberi. He is a boxing champ back from the 90s and had an incredible career. And now is the CEO of Delaware Gives. So when I met with him and we sat down just to talk about Opera Delaware, he was drawing all these parallels between the training that we get as opera singers and the training that he experienced as a boxer and the mental fortitude that you need. And we were just drawing all of these parallels and connections. And then we started talking about the rivalries that happen in opera, these intense battles, these mad scenes and all this stuff. And we said, what if we put it in a boxing ring? Oh, mind explodes. So what we're doing is we're putting on this event where we're creating a makeshift boxing ring in the Opera Delaware Studios. You're getting scenes from Macbeth. You're getting scenes from these big dramatic operas. But we're also getting the color commentary of Dave Tiberi and I as the co-MCs. We're also going to have gals holding up the signs, you know, round one, round two. So it's a mix of opera and boxing. And we get to play in this space because of the relationships that we build in Delaware. So it's an honor to get to work with someone like Dave Tiberi with his incredible network. And for him to see what we're doing and invest in it is really such a testament. So I'm really, really excited about that coming up in November.
This season also seems to do a lot to, and I mean this in the most positive way, subvert the stereotypical opera image as being kind of staid and stuffy. There's this really refreshing sense of joy and sense of humor in this season.
Mm-hmm. You know, a thing we talk about a lot is about expanding and extending the opera experience, that it's not about changing what opera is. It's not about, you know, there are a lot of different ideas now of what opera needs to survive and to propel for the future. For me, for us at Opera Delaware, the idea is about really enhancing that community experience surrounding the opera. I want you coming early. I want you meeting up with friends. I want you getting to know the singers. So many of us are so isolated these days. I really see the arts as a way for us to connect as a community. And so then the quality of the opera speaks for itself, but also when it's rooted in joy, the audience feels that. And I think that's what makes the whole Opera Delaware experience. Whenever people tell me I've never been to an opera before, I'm like, perfect. You are exactly who I'm looking for, because I want us to be your first opera experience. I want you to feel joyful and present and comfortable. You're a part of this, right?
Thanks to soprano Emily Markovich, a company artist with Opera Delaware, and Carrie-Anne Otagno, Opera Delaware's Vice President for Engagement, for joining our Martin Matheny on this edition of Arts Playlist. Head to DelawarePublic.org for our complete interview with Carrie-Anne and Emily. And you can find out more about Opera Delaware's 2025-2026 season online at operade.org. Up next, we wrap up this week's show with the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you the final episode of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. The podcast explores how Delawareans connect to the environments and cultures around them, and the cultural practices and creative works that bring us closer to the planet we call home. On this final episode, we feature a more grounded personal look at the impact of connecting to nature and culture. The natural world and cultural identity have played a substantial role in writer and nature photographer Leslie Sue Oh's professional and personal journey. Her work has taken her around the country and the world to experience the vast array of what the planet and its cultures have to offer. And the memoir she's working on, Fireweed, weaves together themes of family, cultural identity, and the natural world to tell her very personal story of self-discovery and healing after experiencing profound loss. Your connection to nature and the natural world started young. I saw one quote from you where you said you feel like you grew up in the national parks of the United States and Canada. Can you give us a sense of what those formative years were like and how they created a foundation for your life and career?
Sure. So I was raised by a very exciting, adventurous mother who thought it was more important to play with her kids. She fell in love with national parks in 1967 when she was on a honeymoon with my dad. And they were in Shenandoah National Park. And she was like, I want to see all the national parks in the United States and Canada. And so when my brother and I were born, she started taking us to national parks. That was like our thing. And what was cool, she was a photographer. So every national park we went to, I felt like I always had the weight of a camera around my neck because she would have one and I would have, and she would be teaching me like how to compose photos. And she was always asking me like, what story are you trying to tell? So for example, one of my favorite photos of hers is one where my brother and I are walking or wading through a field of beach grass in Channel Islands National Park. And both of us are not paying any attention to her. Didn't even know she was studying us through her lens. And my hair is hanging across my face. You can't see if my eyes are open or shut, but it's such a classic photo of hers because it captures us listening. We're silent and we're listening to the sounds of maybe like, you know, the grass waving in the wind and that kind of stuff. So I feel very lucky that she raised me that way, where we were in the present moment a lot. And that's a lesson that I would forget and not remember until years later when a very famous traditional healer in Alaska, who unfortunately passed away, Auntie Rita, used to try to teach me these lessons when she took me out foraging for different plants. And she would remind me that children are very good at staying in the present moment. And I think that's what national parks did for us.
And I guess you could see that almost direct through line from that experience when you were young to what you ultimately wound up doing as a career.
Yes, except I, you know, my birth mom and dad are, you know, Chinese. I was born in North Carolina. So they did not want me to be a writer. They wanted me to be a doctor. So I sort of like, I would say it was because my mother and brother died of the same disease very shortly before I turned 21. That changed everything. Because at that point in time, I was set to be a doctor. Meanwhile, I had all these journals that I had written in national parks, like through my childhood, but that's not what I was being groomed for. So backing up a little bit, I guess I was a freshman in college. My brother was 17. He wakes up with extreme pain in his side and we discover it's liver cancer caused by hepatitis B. And then I lose him the following year at 18. And a week after he died, my mother was diagnosed with the same disease. So I think if my mother didn't die, I think I might have still tried to pursue medicine. But after she died too, I lost both of them. I was like, well, I don't believe in medicine anymore. I believe in prevention. And so that's when I got a degree in public health to satisfy my dad, who still wants me to be a doctor. So fireweed. My memoir is called Fireweed.
I was going to say, I mean,
So, yeah.
you detail this journey you're talking about, coping with that loss of your brother and your mother in that memoir, Fireweed. What prompted you to write such a deeply personal memoir about that?
Honestly, that's kind of how I healed from the deaths, and it's still a work in progress, but now it evolved and grown to cover almost 20 years from after my mother and brother died until I became like a mother of four. So ultimately what happens is my mother's dying request was for my dad to take me to Alaska and finish all the national parks we didn't do finish together. So at that point in time when they died, we had seen nearly all the national parks in the US and Canada. I think my mother understood that my healing would depend on the natural world, and that the indigenous people most intimate to these places. But my father grieved in a very traditional Chinese way. He sold our house, got remarried, had another son, pretended that everything was fine, nothing bad had happened. And my relatives expected me to do the same thing. So instead, I ran off to Glacier National Park. And so that's kind of where the memoir starts. But what I realized over time is like, keep going back to this image of fireweed, because when you ask me about that time in my life, like what I imagine is the only way I feel like I can cope with that time in my life is to imagine my emotional and mental landscape is like the blast zone after Mount St. Helens erupted. It's basically the largest, most powerful natural disaster in US history. It flattened and scorched 500-year-old firs, flattened cedar, and killed all the fish and salamanders. And that's how I felt. And the ecologists and geologists theorized that it would take centuries for life to return. But they went back a week after the eruption and were surprised to discover a little tiny green shoot, which ended up being fireweed. And so I have been collecting fireweed all throughout my childhood, not knowing that this is a plant that colonizes burnt and devastated landscapes. So the story, the memoir, is about how I eventually find things that symbolize fireweed in my life, but maybe I don't recognize that. And among that is like my husband and my kids, because I swore I would never have children or get married without her. and also, fireweed to me is the mothers that adopted me shortly after my mother died. And I want to acknowledge these mothers because these are the mothers who shaped my connection with our planet. So I mentioned my birth mother and her way of introducing me to the natural world, but it was Ursula Noki Wilson, a Navajo midwife who I met at a conference like a couple years after my mom died. And I went up to her after the conference because I knew I just felt like I had to speak to her. And before I even said anything, she grabbed my hand and said, "Our paths were meant to cross." And she adopted me a few years later, adopted my husband as well at our wedding, and gave me a Navajo name that means journey with caring and journey to bring out gifts. And I feel like that's what guides my artistic intention. It's being a storyteller and a photographer that serves a people or place.
You mentioned this piece of your journey with dealing with your own Chinese heritage and then kind of moving some of these indigenous culture and traditions into your life. And how important was kind of reconciling all those things to helping you find the path you wound up on?
It was hard because obviously I didn't want to culturally appropriate or, I think I always try to make sure I acknowledge who it is that taught me these things. So Ursula is an important lesson to my kids too. She would teach them how to make fry bread, and she would explain to them that the mountains are mothers, you know, that everything in the natural world is our relative. And she would teach the kids how to, you know, if you're going to go climb on a mountain, and they're all snowboard cross competitors. So she's like, before you go snowboard, thank this mountain before you recreate on it, you know, and give it a blessing. So these are all things that I was taught, and I shared it with my children, of course, but didn't know if I could share that in my writing. And I was encouraged by my mom. She likes me to call her my res mom. That I am hers, you know, that's what she always said. And so that I like these were things that my readers didn't know about, that they appreciated it when I shared that kind of information. And before I get too far, I want to also thank Elaine Abraham, who in 2016 she passed away. That was when my youngest was born. And she and I had met like 10 or 20 years before that, when I was working in Alaska and for the Alaska Native Science Commission. And she is the last matriarch of the Tlingit Raven Moiety Copper River Clan Owl House. And she invited me to Yakutat to cover her story about a potlatch, which I was felt very honored that she trusted me to write about it. And, you know, the whole potlatch thing is thrown after someone passes away. And it's all about the whole community coming together and helping you to grieve in a sense, but also to give gifts to everybody at the end. So that there's a balance of like, okay, sadness and happiness. And so the memoir ends with Elaine passing away, and at her potlatch, she asks her children to adopt our family. So, what for me, I felt my losing my mother and my brother, and also my dad, was like losing my anchor. And when a lot of us are in the diasporic, you know, families, we're not anchored to land. And I was on the search, like after my mom died, to connect to a place and a landscape that would be permanent enough that if something should happen to me, my kids, you know, will have a place to go to that they know is home and where we are, we're rooted. But Elaine and her family are continuing to be a very important part of my life and my children's. And what I'm seeing now that my kids are 20, 17, 12 and 9. The older two, they founded a fly fishing club at their high school because they felt that where we live in Lake Tahoe, watersheds is it doesn't behave like other watersheds. Most watersheds drain into the ocean, but where we live here in the Truckee River watershed, the water begins with Lake Tahoe, drains into Truckee River, but terminates at Pyramid Lake. My kids wanted to bring fly fishing out to the kids out in Pyramid Lake and also educate their peers about how everything we do up here impacts the Pyramid Lake Paiute Reservation. And so for the last 4 years, they've been distributing fly fishing rods to the indigenous youth out there. And I mean, it's just a start, but there's fly fishing buddies that the high school kids here in Lake Tahoe make with the Pyramid Lake kids. And now they're calling each other and going fishing together. Really nice to see that that's happening.
I was going to say, your family obviously is a big part of your story, and as you've noted, kind of continuing now with your children. And in our last episode, we were talking with a local zoo and natural history museum about their efforts to engage family and kids and kind of make those connections in young people with the natural world around them. What's your advice to families about finding those connections to nature and the environment and the impact it can have, as you kind of just noted with your kids and the fly fishing program?
I write a lot about how I introduced these concepts to my kids. So a lot of the things I write about shows other families how to introduce like adventures to your children at a young age. And like don't be afraid to ask different tour operators, like if they have a minimum age requirement. Sometimes they'll work with you to figure out a way to make it work. For example, when we went to Wrangell St. Elias, my son was only 2. He just learned how to walk, but we wanted to hike a glacier. And he was too young, and but we wanted him to be part of experience. And so the tour operator found adult instep crampons. They usually fit in the middle of an adult person's foot, but they were able to fit that on his little feet. And I remember the two, at that time, 5 and 2 years old, running up the glacier. I hadn't finished putting on my crampons, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, I hope they don't trip or kick each other. But they didn't. They were fine. One of my mentors told me, like, think about when you put kids out in, they go outside and it's raining. He said, don't tell them to put on a jacket. The way he explained to me is that you're conditioning the child to believe that rain is bad. And so all my kids are in Boy Scouts. Sometimes we go camping, and when it rains, everybody disappears. And we're like, why did everyone leave? And so my kids are like, why are people scared when the weather is bad? Or, and I think it's because we are often placed in situations where adventures do go wrong. And honestly, we just say, okay, what do we do about it? So they're really great problem solvers. And I appreciate traveling with them now because they just like when something goes wrong, and if I like freak out about something, they're like, that's okay. We'll do something else, you know, like they can pivot really easily, which I appreciate. And I'm encouraged by my friends to share kind of how I do that. Like, how do I place children in adventures where it's slightly out of their comfort zone, but, you know, not too much to ask them to just face their fear. And when they overcome that fear, I see them as being very resilient children. And so I hope to share all that information.
So I'm curious. I mean, obviously, you've traveled extensively and your writing and photography have covered a tremendous amount of ground. Are there certain things you're looking for when deciding what to focus on, what stories you want to tell?
Yeah, so for me, the story will sometimes chase me. I'll give you an example. I was invited by the Adventure Travel Trade Association on a trip to Brazil. We basically went on a different adventures that they planned for us, and then we would give them our opinion of how this adventure might work when they open up these opportunities for other people. And so there's a cave in Brazil that's called the Devil's Cave. It's the longest cave in the world. And I thought I was going to write about that. What ended up happening on that trip was we rappelled down this 100-foot cliff, and I took out my iPhone, snapped a picture of my friend Josiah coming down, and he's our videographer on this trip. And so I felt, oh, I should get a good picture of him. And I just snapped it and looked at it, and I knew I had a winner. But 2 hours later, after we were swimming through this cave, and very interesting cave, by the way, because you have to pull yourself through. Some of the areas are so deep that you have to pull yourself with a rope, like through these tunnels and things like that. And then at the end, there's a huge waterfall that's very strong, and we all wanted to get a picture under it. When I stepped under that waterfall, my phone, which was inside of a Sea to Summit like waterproof bag, it slipped out of my pocket. We all tried to look for it, couldn't find it was very murky waters. And then I followed the guide underneath the waterfall because that's where he was going, and didn't realize it was a very long swim. And so I tried to come up for air, and I couldn't find my way to the other cave. And so he pulled me out by my hair, and I was just like, okay, we're done. I don't care about the phone anymore, but it's probably going to be found years from now. But it's that picture. I really want that picture. So 2 days later, one of the guys, they found me. They surprised me with my phone.
Wow.
So this story, I'm telling it terribly. So I should probably direct you to reading it because it's ultimately about the kindness of the people in Brazil, right? Who would go back into that cave, which took almost, I would say, several hours to get to that point. And then he dived for my phone with a pair of goggles. And he found it churning at the bottom of this waterfall because it was so strong. It created like this like ditch that it was stuck in. The bag wasn't even sealed. The phone was still on. By the time I got it, of course, it died. But when I turned it on after putting it on rice for a day, it was still posting something that I was trying to do on Facebook before I walked into the cave. And the photo, of course, got published in Alpinist magazine, along with a story. And so you should check out that story. It's called Lost and Found. And ultimately the lesson there being, the extent that some stranger would go out of their way to like it's like I wanted to take a picture of my friend and they wanted to retrieve something that was very difficult to get. So
That is a great story. I do want to mention you did spend some time living here in Delaware, and in 2019 won a Delaware Division of the Arts Individual Fellowship for an established professional in literature. And I'm curious, how did your time in Delaware contribute to your journey? And is there anything about the First States landscape and environment that you connected with?
yes. So I moved to Delaware in 2015 when my kids were 10, 7, and 2, and the youngest one wasn't even born yet. And it was about the time I had been teaching up until that point creative writing. And I always wanted to be a travel writer, but my parents always, they were very negative about me pursuing a writing career. I also thought becoming a travel writer was impossible when you're a mother of three. Of course, now I'm a mother of four. And that was when I started pitching to Washington Post. I started writing for Outside around then that time as well. And Condé Nast Traveler, Travel and Leisure. Like that's kind of the years that where I first started. And I think what I loved about Delaware was the community. There was a writers group actually founded by Jen Epler and Mark Borman. And it was inspired by actually the Wilmington Writers Conference in June 2017 at the Delaware Art Museum. So they formed a writers group and invited me to be part of that. And so they're definitely going to be mentioned in my acknowledgments for my memoir because they all critiqued parts of it. And there were so many, like we would just rent a cabin somewhere in one of the state parks and spend a whole weekend writing together. And those things, it hasn't happened for me out here where I am now, but I miss that. Yeah, many thanks to Delaware for also supporting me at a time when I had young children, because I really helped me to be able to make progress on my memoir.
Since this is the season finale of the podcast, you get the final word. So I wanted to ask,
Oh,
when you think about what people can learn from their planet, what do you feel they should try to focus on?
well, I like the advice of every guest that you've brought on have provided very simple, practical tips. The one that sticks out to me is that I already have wrote down, and we're going to make that change in our family, is to install yellow light bulbs outside of our house instead of the white ones so that the bugs aren't attracted to it. There are other, I love those kind of simple, I think, incremental changes that we can make. My kids are really into, they're worried about the those coffee pods that we drink. I think they've gotten better. There are pods now that are safer, but usually you have to take them apart and then dump the grounds out separately and recycle just like the cup part. Well, for years we have tried to do this in our household, and I'm very embarrassed that we still don't have a good system. Like oftentimes we collect it all in a bag, and then by the time we get to it, it's all mildewed. So be, I say be kind to yourself and just try something. If it doesn't work for your family, find something else simple that you can do that will take care of, that will help the planet. Whether it's taking shorter showers, turning off lights, or I share a lot about what Auntie Rita Blumenstein instructed about harvesting. Like when you're out, don't take all of the plants that you're collecting, leave some for the animals, right? And then maybe just understanding that these natural resources are relatives instead of a resource, maybe that's a start.
You've been listening to a portion of the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet, with writer and nature photographer Leslie Sue Oh. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. People and Planet is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. And that'll do it for this edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, the staff at Delaware Humanities and Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.